JEA's CEO could be out of a job today, but that won't end the investigation into Jacksonville's utility. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead on the show this morning, we speak with Councilmember Brenda Priestley Jackson about major new developments in the JEA affair. We're already getting your calls. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, dealing with holiday stress, a little timely advice for us all. But first this morning, embattled JEA CEO Aaron Zahn could be fired today by the utility's board of directors. The board is meeting as we speak to debate Zahn's fate with the city's publicly owned asset. All of this as controversy grows over Zahn's leadership at JEA and a derailed bonus scheme for executives that's been blasted by both local officials and the public. Brenda Priestley Jackson has been vocal about JEA controversies from the get-go. The city council member introduced an emergency resolution last week calling for the utility to stop seeking bids to privatize. Priestley Jackson joins us now with her thoughts about the latest developments, and they are coming thick and fast. Councilmember Brenda Priestley Jackson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Already getting your calls out there. Let us know your thoughts on the JEA affair. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open as well. Councilmember Jackson, what are your impressions after yesterday's fact-finding hearing in City Council chambers where Mr. Zahn tried to defend himself before you and your colleagues?
Okay, so I was not physically present. I was actually out of town, but I had an opportunity to hear some of it, the live stream of it, and follow up on it that way. I want to commend my colleagues, Ron Salem and Rory Diamond, for this level of inquiry. I think that it became glaringly obvious that the events that transpired on July 23rd, which was when the JEA board met and decided the PUP, but more importantly for me, decided they would pursue an ITN.
Invitation to negotiate.
That all acts by that, the JEA board and the executives on that day need to be closely scrutinized. I think they're wrought with ethical conflicts. I think they're wrought with possible legal conundrums. But more importantly, that it was just not a moral and just meeting. It was not noticed, so it didn't conform to the sunshine. And if you are going to offer an incentive plan to executives largely, right, based on the idea of selling our municipal utility, at the same time you go out to solicit bids on our municipal utility, that's unconscionable. And so I think through the conversation and the dialogue for 4 hours yesterday, it was glaringly obvious that those acts by the executive that were recommended to the board on the 23rd of July need to be scrutinized, and probably a lot of them voided.
Your colleague Matt Carlucci on the city council has called for a grand jury investigation. Do you join him in that?
Well, I think the beauty of a 19-member council is that we all have different angles that we look at this issue. And so I have often posited under the leadership of Council President Wilson that we don't all have to sing from the same hymn. We just have to be in the same hymnal. And so I think that is totally within Councilmember Carlucci's purview to make that request. That is not where I'm starting. I am looking at how do we get to this point, which was just very challenging for me. How do we find ourselves in this position with lack of knowledge? And that's why I have advanced to the resolution that we have not complied with the Florida statutes, with Sunshine Law, or the Charter, or just our standard operations of how we engage one another, whether it's the JEA board and city council.
It's 549-2937 to connect right now with Jacksonville City Council member Brenda Priestley Jackson, speaking out on JEA as JEA CEO Aaron Zahn could lose his job today as he goes before his board of directors. The fate of the utility is also up in the air. Now, Ms. Jackson, you introduced an emergency resolution several weeks ago calling for JEA to just stop this whole controversial process, stop taking bids from private buyers. Your members will take that up again in January. Is it your hope that they pass this resolution, which would be symbolic, but would still be a powerful rebuke to JEA's push to privatize?
Absolutely. Well, my first hope is that today that the JEA board would rescind it on its own. So it was very clear. I introduced the legislation on actually December the 4th. It became published on December 5th, and I had a notice meeting with Council President Wilson and some of my colleagues on December 6th. And so I introduced a resolution, and these were the factors. I introduced a resolution requiring the JEA board to rescind the ITN. And why I made that request were several factors. The first was they had not properly noticed their meeting on on July 23rd. So if their meeting on June 25th, they ended that meeting with the CEO, Mr. Zahn, stating that they were going to pursue a traditional utility response with charter changes. And there was a motion to that effect. Now, let's be clear, a little better than a year prior, they had already passed their own resolution saying they would not privatize. Prior to that, in February of 2018, the Office of General Counsel gave a memo to the mayor, city council, and the JEA board that said, if you're going to pursue privatization, you need to work in collaboration with the city council. And the city council should, by resolution, articulate what a process of exploration of this looked like. So that had not been followed. But it's very disturbing to find out that our JEA board, which is an independent advisory board to an independent authority, would have a meeting on the 23rd of July that was not duly noticed, and then conform the agenda after the meeting to actions that were taken. And that action was to offer an ITN, and now we know to offer the PUP as well.
Okay, your president, Scott Wilson, who is the current Jacksonville City Council president, he could form an investigative committee. He could issue subpoenas. That has the power to put all of these officials under oath. Do you think that should be done?
I think that we have to follow the inquiry to see where it leads. In terms of how did the JEA officials decide that it was appropriate for them to have a pay-for-performance scheme of our municipal utility based on selling our municipal utility? And so I think it is totally within Council President Wilson's discretion to decide to do that. I will share, you know, I've been an attorney for 24 and a half years, and actually up until about 2008, I did criminal defense. I started off as a public defender. I don't know that we're going to actually find criminal culpability. That's a difference from saying we don't have civil liability. So the criminal culpability is somewhat problematic because I think we're going to find that the JEA board and the executives largely operated in a moral and ethical vacuum when deciding that they could be paid to sell the utility. I don't know if it's criminal, though, because they sought the advice of the general counsel and outside attorneys.
Okay, put another way, I hear you saying you're not sure laws were broken, but you think this is an ethical quagmire. Your colleague on the council, Rory Diamond, said yesterday that this amounts to legal theft, this bonus scheme that has been scrapped. Do you agree?
Well, it would if it would have become into actualization, but they withdrew it. So no one got paid. No actions were taken. So I think had we had the next step, then he would absolutely be right. It would be a legal theft, okay? It would be at that point wrongful taking, but we didn't have it.
Now, in addition to many other issues swirling around Zahn and the utility, we learned that he owns property with a lobbyist who was working on behalf of JEA, seen at the minimum as a conflict of interest. And it turns out the property Mr. Zahn owns is in your council district. Your thoughts?
You can't make this stuff up. So one of the things that I knew that when my colleagues decided they wanted to do the one cycle emergency for my resolution was that we were going to get new facts. There were more bad facts that would be disclosed. And so the fact that was disclosed was that Mr. Zahn, along with the lobbyist, a week after he became the interim CEO, and they just checked the property deeds, purchased property that was formerly owned by CSX for, I would think, about $250,000, now trying to be sold for $2 million. And you cannot, there are three things with this. This is why there should be a cause basis for him being fired today. The first is he did not disclose it on his financial disclosures. Okay, so we're required as elected officials, and he, in his role as the head of our municipal utility, to do a financial disclosure. He didn't do that. Secondly, his contract with the JEA says that he will not have any competing business interests. And that's in the contract. He had a position as an officer in this corporation. And the third was that the very individual that he has the property within the business relationship. He awarded a consulting contract of $120,000, $10,000 a month. Some believe, as a lobbyist, some say to lobby city council to support the JEA sale. Mm. You can't do that.
Last question for you before we go to all of the callers. How much culpability for this whole imbroglio goes to the mayor, in your view?
Well, I think that we cannot separate the fact that the mayor appointed all of these individuals to the JEA board. He appointed Mr. Zahn to the board, and Mr. Zahn then became the interim CEO without any prior experience. So I would believe by his recommendation of appointment of these individuals and by the city council's confirmation of his appointments, that he believed that these individuals mm-hmm. could effectuate his intent. And I think his intent was to sell JEA.
How much goes to the council? How much responsibility?
Well, you know, I think that's interesting. I think that I think we are charged with being active and engaged when we have information. This council is doing that. I think, unfortunately, the prior council thought the matter was dead. I never did, right? You don't make an entire board resign, which he did with JEA. Put your folks on the board. Put your guy in on the board to become interim and not pursue this kind of course of action. So I think people were a bit naive if they are suddenly shocked and in awe that the mayor has come out vocally now to say he supports the privatization of JEA. I've kind of always felt that that was his intent.
Okay, let's go to your calls now for Brenda Priestley Jackson, the Jacksonville City Council member, has introduced an emergency resolution asking JEA to stop its ITN, as it's called, its invitation to negotiate, in effect asking private firms to give them a price to buy them. Where are you on all of these controversies? 549-2937. Scott has been holding. He's on the north side. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, good morning to everybody. First of all, I agree with Councilman Carlucia. I'm sorry. He's absolutely correct. We need to stop. The information that has been provided showed that it's criminal. It is criminal. Before leadership, I'm talking about the mayor, department, JEA, for them to do what they are doing in the community, they are robbing the community of what a valuable asset. And for us to sit back and talk about all the different things we need to be doing, there's only one thing to do, and that's to stop the leadership at JEA and get rid of Zahn. That is the most important thing we need to do before we talk about anything else. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. We should point out that both a current and a former member of JEA's board has called for the termination of Aaron Zahn. He should learn his fate today. He's meeting with the JEA board as we speak, so we'll be monitoring that. 549-2937. Tom is in Arlington. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Isn't this coming to light at the last minute an example of a basic flaw in the independent authority system that we use in our consolidated government, which leaves this weakness, which doesn't necessarily suggest that the council failed in oversight, but that there just might be some basic structural problems?
Right. Let's talk about that. The council has come in for some criticism. The members of this 19-member body, of which you were a part, Brenda Priestley Jackson, have they been too slow to exercise their oversight role in all of those, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think the caller is spot on in terms of the independent authority and how it's structured under our charter. So we really only know the strength of our charter when it's tested. It's being tested now. And so there will be charter changes recommended based on what has happened with JEA. I posited early on that I don't believe the framers of our charter ever contemplated that one of our independent authorities would sell themselves right up out of the charter. Mm-hmm. And so that they could even begin this act without being required to engage city council and residents in Jacksonville is unconscionable. So we will clean that language up. We will look at the powers that they are given and which they operated. But I think that the caller is spot on in terms of this is kind of a, I think of it as kind of a renegade independent authority right now.
Here's a comment on that. This is from our Facebook page. Brian writes, does the city council get to approve appointments to the so-called independent boards, commissions, and authorities? They should. Is that a change that needs to be made? Because under the current system, the mayor, basically under our strong mayor form of government, he had carte blanche, it's my understanding, to put on all of these boards who he wanted. He purged all of the boards and commissions in his first term, which raised a lot of eyebrows, but it wasn't against the law. He just broke precedent when he did that.
Right. So he appoints. So the mayor appoints and then the city council confirms. And so in general, if there is an appointment authority confirmed to the mayor without there being a really strong principled basis, those appointments are usually routinely confirmed by members of the city council. I think we have to look at that. I think there can be a component of utility experience for that board. I think we've got to look at more specialized knowledge for our independent authority, particularly one that's so valuable as the JEA and impacts our overall quality of life.
The city council approved the mayor's, it seems fair to say, his pick to lead JEA, Aaron Zahn. In hindsight, should they have resisted that more? Should they have asked more questions? Should they have pushed back more?
I think they absolutely should have resisted. I mean, and let me just be clear, before you even go to the lack of Mr. Zahn's qualifications, and the fact that we're dealing now with his ethical and moral lapses in terms of the leadership of it, you don't put someone on an independent authority's board and then take that individual to become the head of the organization. That's an inherent conflict.
Right. He was appointed to the board and then elevated to CEO over, critics said, far more qualified
Absolutely.
Candidates, including an internal candidate, Melissa right. Dykes. If Mr. Zahn is fired this week, she potentially could be running the utility, at least for a while.
That's correct. I think that the challenge with that's going to be how much of an interplay and working together with Mr. Zahn is Mrs. Dykes involved in. So, you know, the candidate that she was before he was appointed is not the executive that she is working with him today.
Okay, and it's 549-2937. Mike is along Phillips Highway. Hey, Mike, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate this is a great, necessary thing to be talking about. I think I'm a little frustrated, and I'm probably not the only one when I and I'm Ms. Priestley Jackson. I appreciate you being here and talking to this issue, but when you reduce it to simply criminal or civil issues that need to be hashed out, I think a lot of us are frustrated by the fact that beyond all of that, we don't want this. The people in Jacksonville do not want this. Poll after poll has said we don't want it. And I think a lot of people are very frustrated that the city council isn't standing up for that, that we've elected you and you're not doing what we obviously want you to do, which is to oppose this. This is 100% Curry. Curry is doing this. This is a Curry thing. Curry has campaigned on this. Curry wants this, and we don't. And I think the rest of us want to know, why are you guys dragging your feet on this? It seems like it took Matt Carlucci coming out of the gates and saying something to make something actually happen. So I'll sorry if I got a little bit emotional, but I'm sure I'm not the only one that's emotional about this. But I'll listen off the air. And thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, Mike. Thank you.
Well, let me answer first. So I think that if you have participated in many of the public meetings we've had relative to JEA, it's clear that an overwhelming majority of the city council does not support privatization. And I actually filed my resolution to rescind the ITM because that was the only mechanism available to us at the time to stop the process, right?
So, and you were the first on to speak out to, in stopping the
right,
process,
right? And so, in that resolution, I outlined several factors, everything from the PUP to the failure to collaborate.
That's the bonus
to,
plan,
right?
Yeah.
The bonus plan to the failure to collaborate to the lack of sunshine as the basis, because I want to be really clear. But even though you see legislation right now or public commentary by members of city council right now on things that we want to do to intervene in this process, we have been vocal for months. Ironically enough, the memorandum that was provided by the mayor's office to the JEA board about the role of city council going forward, which I think the memorandum, in all honesty, does not conform to the charter. I don't think the executive can give a co-equal branch like the legislative city council that power. Those are the very acts we've been asking to do for months. We have been asking to do them, and we were told under the charter we could not intervene. I want to remind everybody, we were told we were under a cone of silence. We were under a cone of silence.
The city's lead attorney told you
yes,
that.
The city council was under a cone of silence and could not discuss the invitation to negotiate those who bid on JEA. And what was ironic about that was we don't even know who they are. So we were told we could not talk to who we did not know we could talk to, not talk to.
We have a question for you about that on Facebook from Susan. Do you feel Jason Gabriel, that's the from the Office of General Counsel, has done a good job serving the city council and the school board? That's another controversy, but we'll get into that another day. Does he interpret any activity under the statute the same way you do? Would you vote to remove him? I understand 2/3 of the city council can remove the general counsel. The attorney that you just made reference to.
Right.
Should he be removed?
I don't know that I have the facts to determine that Mr. Gabriel can be removed, but I can clearly say that he serves too many masters. He is the general counsel for the city council, for the mayor, for the independent authorities, and for other branches of government, the school board and all of that. And he serves too many masters. And so
those interests are diverging.
Right.
Now.
And then what happens is if you are appointed by the mayor, and if that is a process, then your natural inclination would be to make certain that those actions and acts that the mayor feels are most important are the ones you give your most of your energy to.
So perhaps that person shouldn't be appointed by the mayor?
No, they should. I think they should be appointed by a panel probably of not only city council, but independent authorities and the school board as well, since that office, that's, 43, 45 attorneys represents all different branches of government.
So that they have more independence, more of an oversight role, and that they can call balls and strikes independently.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you something folks don't know. I joke with Jason Gabriel. He is a University of Florida College of Law graduate, and I graduated University of Florida College of Law probably about 6 years before he did. And under our charter, he is charged with interpreting the charter. He is a tribunal of one. That can't stand. So we've really got to look at cleaning that up. And this is a problem of our modern government, right?
Now, the Charter Revision Commission, they meet once a decade. They've been meeting. Could this be a change they recommend? And how likely would it actually be to come to pass?
Yeah, I don't know. And I think that they have a few attorneys that are on there. I think the committee is headed up by an attorney, and I know W.C. Gentry, who I served on the school board with, is on there. I think that we have to, every problem that's been revealed through the JEA process, we have to go back and look at what created the problem, and the problems are largely created under the construction of the charter at present, and it has to be changed. And that's just kind of, I'm a process person, and so my mind moves that way. That's what I think that's going to be revealed to that. And I think Mr. Gabriel's, the appointment of general counsel, needs to be a more collaborative effort with the different branches of city government.
Lots of calls meanwhile for Brenda Priestley Jackson, Pastor Troy on the east side. Troy, go ahead.
Good morning. I want to, first of all, commend council person, the woman, Jackson, for her courageous stand. And, of course, she and maybe one other councilman appear to be the last Democrat standing. Because here in Duval County, the Democrats appear that they have just laid down. Now, I want to say one thing about Jacksonville's history. Jacksonville has always been run the way it's run. Now, we can laugh about Mayberry and the Dukes of Hazzard. But when you have to live under it, it's a different reality. And that's the reality we live here in Jacksonville. So now it's come to light that the public only owns the JEA on paper. So now that it's being revealed that they've never had any real power and what decisions are made with the board, and now we can finally get that aired out. And so now the people can see. So if there's truly going to be a democracy, we have to start somewhere. And again, I want to commend our councilwoman for having the courage to stand up and put not just mouth, but also action to plan. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
He's giving voice to what a lot of ratepayers and voters out there have been saying, that they don't feel we have a truly representative local government. What about that?
Well, I think that what we find right now, this is what we might want to call a charter revision crisis, right? It's a charter crisis. This is the first time that we have been faced with forces trying to sell one of our greatest assets, JEA, without, you know, residents' buy-in, right? And so that how it came to pass without engagement of the public and a sanctioning from the public is very, very disturbing. And let me tell everybody what I share. This is my firm belief. JEA is somewhat the thread that holds our quality of life together in Jacksonville. Now, I am 53 years old, so JEA has been around for the overwhelming majority of my life. Mm. If you weren't a part of that or didn't necessarily grow up, you may not understand it the same way. And without JEA, we will have two Jacksonvilles. One will be like San Francisco and the other will be like Detroit. And I represent District 10. There are parts of my district where my neighbors have more socioeconomic challenges. They don't have access to the same wealth or income. If we lose JEA, they will find themselves in a position of not being able to maintain their utility bills and their quality of life. And that's a real
If Florida Power and Light or Duke or whoever it may be buys JEA, that will worsen income inequality in Jacksonville? Why?
Absolutely. Because let me tell you, the reimbursements we get because we have a municipally owned utility, we get federal and state reimbursements, FEMA. We also have an offset in our support of the public schools because of contributions by JEA, right? Then that means that we get pure pupil funding from the state at a certain level. If we lose that, we lose that funding from the state as well, okay? Aside from the fact that JEA has, 2,000 employees? Right. JEA has a defined pension plan for many of the employees that are there that was passed off to the city on top of the other pension debt that we have in the event it was recapitalized. It touches every facet of life. Water, the water rights at JEA. The reality is around the country where they have moved away from municipal ownership of the utility to private ownership, they want it back and can't get it back. It's a not-for-profit for a reason because it's designed to provide high-quality services and innovate.
Okay, emails and tweets coming in for Brenda Priestley Jackson. Here is an email from a listener. For a very long time, a majority bought into the Republican belief that privatization and taxpayer savings go hand in hand. Maybe the citizens are finally waking up to the fact that these initiatives are nothing more than a way to benefit private companies that are all too often political donors, he says. Okay, here's a tweet from a listener. Is an attempted theft still a crime? Scheming to break the law is against the law in itself. That JEA pulled the plug on it doesn't unring the bell.
Well, I think that let me tell you why I think that this may be different. If now mind you, let me be clear. I think that the PUP, the performance unit plan, was morally and ethically corrupt and bankrupt. I think it should have never happened. I think it was not duly noticed. I think it should have never been put on the table. And I thank our council auditors for discovering it. Let's be clear. Thank them for calling our attention. But if an entity undertakes a course of action, right, or the executives, and they are advised by general counsel, by outside counsel, that this may be a possibility, and it's an unknown area, then that's why there becomes a challenge with there being criminal liability. Civil, absolutely. But if that's an unknown area that they could receive, you know, corporate performance component or an individual performance component, which they were under this, for a municipal utility because it hadn't been done before, therein lies the challenge with there being criminal liability. However, I think there's an opportunity for us now to say why we might want to have our legislators make it a criminal liability going forward.
All right, let's take one more call. It's Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. On your show, I know you've had a number of people on who've been pretty much against the sale of JEA. And I'm not necessarily for it or against it, but I just wanted to ask your guest thoughts on this thought. If you step back and you look at what does JEA have, they have a bunch of customers and they have some infrastructure. Take water out of it for a moment. But they have a bunch of customers and they have some infrastructure. I called into the show a week or two ago and asked one of your, it was a JEA guest, what percentage of power does JEA actually produce on their own? Not through other partnerships, but that produce on their own. And she didn't have an answer. And my thought is, if they don't really produce a lot of our own power, then that's all that we have is this asset. And if you look forward about 10 years from now, is there a chance that you're better off selling this asset now and hopefully taking the money and using it wisely? I understand all of the criticisms about how this process has been going in, but I think a lot of people forget there were five different proposals that JEA is wanting to put forward.
Right.
And one of them, yes, is a sale to a private entity.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so let's discuss the arguments on the merits. The argument for doing something different, which is what JEA's leadership is saying market forces demand that they do.
Okay. So the problem with that is that it was not undertaken in the sunshine, openly and honestly. And so one of the things that I've said is that one of the greatest drawbacks to this process and what has been revealed by the failure to conform to Florida statutes, the charter, and the PUP, is that we will really never evaluate in real time the merits of pursuing privatization because it's corrupt as an inception. And so
there could be a real case to be made, but they haven't made it in the right way, is what you're saying.
And it's corrupt right now, right? So we don't really know the valuation of the asset, right? So, you know, bond rating companies were told one value, locally the sky was falling. You know, so there are questions regarding the veracity and integrity of the information that has been provided throughout this process. And I think there are questions regarding the veracity and integrity because the goal was to get it up for sale. And let me say why I think that was the goal. I think that there's an allure that at any given time, JEA has $1 billion in cash assets. I think that can be very enticing to some in elected office of taking that billion to pay down other responsibilities and then believing the market can deal with everything going forward. But that's not how JEA was structured. So you have to understand historically how it came to be and how it has so many tentacles in different aspects of society.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add before we wrap it up? How would you like this process to go forward?
Well,
I
think that the JEA board has rescinded the ITN. I think forthwith, then after the city council, our council president gets our outside counsel, I think the city council then has to look at what changes need to be made immediately to our charter and this process to make certain that we are not find ourselves in this situation again. And let's be clear, we still have real time issues. You know, so there are infrastructure issues.
This has been detracting from all these other problems.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think it's causing unrest. I think folks understand, I believe it's related to our spike in crime. I think it's related to our overall lack of well-being in Jacksonville because people believe that there's a process going forward that is corrupt and that they don't think that anybody's advocating for them. So we've got to restore the balance.
Well, we thank you for joining us and we will continue to follow it. Brenda Priestley Jackson serves in District 10 of the Jacksonville City Council. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
A quick break. And up next, how to fight holiday stress. Are you feeling it? I am. We'll be right back.
On the next Planet Money, we meet an economist that some call Scrooge.
I think some people perceive me as attacking Christmas, which I never meant to, just the sloppy way that we celebrate it.
And on How I Built This, got too many toys with screens? Meet Melissa and Doug.
We said, wow, wouldn't that be great if we could do a tactile puzzle?
On the next Planet Money
and How I Built This from NPR.
Sunday afternoon at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hey, what's jazzin'? This is Damian Lamar. Join me for Taste Test and broaden your musical palate as we redefine urban radio. Have a taste tonight from 11 p.m. to midnight here on WJCT 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, if you're feeling stressed or even depressed at the holidays, you're not alone. Plenty of factors can contribute to making the holidays anything but joyful for millions of Americans. Dr. Melissa Fenton is a licensed psychotherapist at Jacksonville's Mind, Body, and Beyond Center. I spoke with her about holiday stress and what we can all do about it. Take a listen. Dr. Melissa Fenton, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
So this is the time of year that's supposed to be the most wonderful time of the year, but instead for most of us, it's the most stressful time of the year. What do you think is the biggest driver of holiday stress?
Well, I would say that's a great question. There are so many parts or layers to stress and even anxiety during this time of year. And the reason is it can be triggered by so many things. We have a huge to-do list, most of us, things that we have to get done. We have family gatherings, holiday travel, you know, work and friend parties, shopping. There's so many. And then even lost loved ones, memories of loved ones that have passed. And then, of course, you have the divorce. 55% of marriages end in divorce. So just having to navigate sharing the children during the holidays, those are triggers as well to stress. To name more, if I can move on, I mean, there's such a list. Traveling back to childhood home and the stress of falling back into old roles or patterns can cause stress. And the thing is that we're forced when we travel back home often to go back into those old roles. And it's hard for most of us to do that. And we're forced to spend time with those that we don't necessarily enjoy. Certainly we have those family members and friends that we do like spending time with, but invariably there's one or two in the group that make us uncomfortable. So setting boundaries where we limit our time with those people that cause us stress is important. And then, of course, when we're at our parties or family gatherings, we often overindulge in food and alcohol. So that, and then lack of sleep, so many more expectations. We all have such high expectations of ourselves and others during the holidays. And the financial strain that we have with travel, entertainment, and gifts. So
all of that together, you just laid out this long, horrible list. It makes me wonder why we even bother, you know?
I know, because really in each of us, we have memories. There are happy memories from our childhood. And certainly when we think of the expectations of family, of that Norman Rockwell scene, that everyone's happy at the table and they're sharing and wonderful gift giving, all of those things we have in our memories, either from something that we had from our childhood or that we're just trying to achieve that because we compare it to other people's, the way they social media portrays that. We look to Pinterest to make those kind of special moments, and oftentimes we feel we can't measure up to what we're seeing on social media or Pinterest. So that's why I say there are so many layers and parts. Certainly the good things, I don't want to overshadow with the negative, stressful things. I mean, it is still a wonderful, joyful time where we have the chance to reconnect with friends or family. We have time off, and there can be a lot of love and celebration and togetherness. So those are the good things.
Right. And we need to try to focus on that. What advice do you have for families to combat all this stress and anxiety at the holidays?
Right. So each of these pieces, have their own tips and tools to combat the stress. I would say first and foremost, getting back to thinking about what do you value individually? What is your personal idea of what makes the holiday special for you? And that can be so individualized. So assuming that what society portrays through our commercials, through the Norman Rockwell scenes, that obviously can set us up for failure, but if we can break it down to what it is that we value. Is it spending time with friends? having time off of work to relax and or decorating our home and baking our favorite dishes, different things, that as there are so many components that make up the holidays, it's really you sitting down and thinking, what is it that I value? And trying to stick to that. The expectations of the holidays can be so, so high. We set the bar very high, most of us, wanting to find the perfect gift. So to answer your question, what do you do with that? You lower your expectations first and foremost. And by doing that, again, going back to the idea of what do I value? And where do I want to put my focus? Knowing that we can't place our focus and create the perfect holiday gathering, party, experience. And so we need to really set realistic expectations based on our values. So if, for instance, if you value having a gathering at your home with your friends and family and your food, what you're making is so important to you, then focusing more on that and less on all the other things, such as the decorations, having the house perfectly clean, because likely most people are not going to notice those things.
Right. So you don't have to be perfect, and you can say no to things. You don't have to go to every event that you're invited
right.
to. You don't have to.
Exactly.
You don't have to do everything that your neighbors are doing at the holidays. That's something I've embraced more and more as I go along. So, great advice. Thank you so much for bringing some sanity back to our lives as we talk, as we make our way through this holiday season. She's Dr. Melissa Fenton with Mind, Body, and Beyond in Jacksonville at the Mind, Body, and Beyond Center. Thank you so much, Dr. Fenton.
You're welcome. Well, thank you for having me, and I wish everyone a happy holiday, and I hope that you will focus on what it is that is valuable to you during the holidays and stick to that and surround yourself with those people that support you and love you, because the holidays is really about connecting with loved ones and giving. So getting back to those values and seeing what you can do to follow through on those values would certainly help alleviate the stress. And so I hope that each of you tries that and see if you can have a less stressful season this year than you did in the years past.
Let's hope so. Thanks again.
Sounds good to me. Thanks again, Dr. Fenton. She is with Mind, Body, and Beyond Center. A quick break, and in a moment, major advancements in the field of vision expected in 2020. We'll have some tips about that next.
$1 million in it, cold hundreds of G's. Enough to buy a phone, magic car with ease. But I never feel for Santa, but that ain't right. So I was going home to mail it back to him that night. But when I got home, I bumped, cause under the tree was a letter from Santa, and the door was for me.
The Pontevedra Concert Hall presents flamenco guitarist Otmar Liebert with Luna Negra on Wednesday, January 15th. Liebert is best known for his international blend of New Age, jazz, and flamenco. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster.com.
Chuck Coma nearly died in prison with injuries that left him permanently disabled. An official told his mother it was a suicide attempt.
He said he tried to kill himself. It was a suicide. No, he didn't.
No, he didn't. NPR obtained the internal investigation report. I'm Ari Shapiro. How a victim of prison violence is coping this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. I'm Tanya Mosley. After several anti-abortion laws were passed around the country, Republicans in Ohio are now taking things further, proposing a bill that would make it a felony to purposely perform or have an abortion. A sponsor says the goal is to end abortion in its entirety. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
America is scoring badly in a global test of reading and math skills. Again, the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, shows scores for disadvantaged students continue to decline. But PISA is far from perfect. How should schools, teachers, and students raise standards? And who gets to judge? Reading, writing, and revamping. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, if you wear contacts or glasses or you've contemplated eye surgery, listen up. Major advancements in the field of vision are expected in 2020. To learn more, I spoke with renowned First Coast eye surgeon, Dr. Arun Gulani. Let's listen.
Dr. Arun Gulani, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
There is so much happening in your field, improving people's vision. What are you looking at? What are some of the big advancements coming down the pike in 2020?
Oh, a lot of exciting things happening in the year 2020, as you can tell, especially in the field of eye surgery and vision. The main categories I'd like to break this into is, let's first take the most common surgery done in the entire field of medicine, which is cataract surgery. Everybody who lives long enough beyond 60 years of age will surely have a cataract. So every patient needs cataract surgery. But surgery nowadays is still done in hospitals and surgical centers, but it has now been brought into a suite concept that we have started, one of the first in the world, where you are actually brought into a spa-like atmosphere and you go through a very comfortable surgery in a few minutes and you can literally drive back home. More importantly, recently the FDA approved a trifocal lens implant, meaning, as you know, people wear glasses for bifocals or trifocals to see distance and near. Now, you can actually put a lens after cataract surgery in your eye that in most cases can make you see without glasses at all distances. So that's a tremendous leap as far as advance in cataract surgery is concerned, right from the facility in which it's done now, artificial intelligence space suite, to the technology and the lens choices you have.
That is a huge leap for patients. What's the second one?
The second, again, if you take the most common surgery done in ophthalmology or eye surgery, it's LASIK, which is to help people see without glasses and contact lenses. These are people who may be nearsighted, farsighted, or astigmatism. Now, a newer version of that technique and technology is what we've been bringing in for the next year. It's called laser plastic, which is a surgery where there's no cutting or no blades like LASIK. And therefore, it's much more safer, more predictable, and in many cases, actually, people can see beyond 20/20. And these are also patients who may have been told they're not a LASIK candidate, for example, with patients with thin cornea, large pupil, high astigmatism. So that's another leap in this surgery, which so many patients, millions of patients are having. Laser plastic now is a reality that we are now bringing in, and that will be a future very soon. And, of course, the third category that everybody's been waiting for is the after-40 reading glasses, the pesky cheaters, that, again, everybody needs at some point after the age of 40. For that, now there are technologies where not only we can do laser techniques, but you can also do lens techniques, Melissa, where you can free patients up of reading glasses and they can start seeing like they were young again.
Wow. I wouldn't mind ditching my reading glasses. That's interesting. Now, and let me ask you as well about a relatively new advance in the field of vision surgery. People actually trying to change their eye color, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's new there?
Yeah. So first of all, there are various modalities by which people can change the color of their eyes, right? Everybody wants the baby blue and icy gray, and many lucky people are born with these colors. But there are safe ways of doing this for the right candidate. We have seen quite a few patients, actually, who had complications of improper surgeries done elsewhere. And we recently corrected a young girl from California, which was in the news, where we corrected her back to her nice green-colored eyes. So this is surely possible, but please make sure you're a good candidate for these surgeries. Related to this surgery is patients who have red eyes all the time from dryness and a condition called pterygium, right? Very prevalent in Florida, sunny climate. These are golfers, surfers, people who are outdoors, and even beauty-related. News anchors, movie stars, they want their eyes to look sparkling white. So there is a new technology and surgery, actually, we just wrote a textbook on, where people don't have to live with red eyes anymore. It can be converted, or it can be corrected to sparkling white, and they can go out with confidence again.
This is amazing stuff. It's almost like science fiction. You can't believe it's really happening, but it is. And you really are a leader in the field. So we thank you so much for sharing this with us. Lots coming into view, pun intended, in 2020. If you are seeking some kind of vision improvement surgery, Dr. Arun Gulani is director of the Gulani Vision Institute in Jacksonville. Dr. Gulani, thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa, again for having me.
Very interesting stuff happening there. And you can find Gulani, Dr. Gulani, at the website gulanivision.com. Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum directs the show. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. We always value your feedback. Please keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We will be off the air once again tomorrow morning for continuing NPR coverage of the impeachment process in Washington. But we will be back to connecting with you locally on Thursday morning. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.